From Australian Book Review, this is the ABR podcast, home to some of the magazine's finest reviews, interviews, poetry, fiction, and commentary. My name's Peter Rose, and I'm the editor of ABR.
Most elections, for anything really, dog catcher, local mayor, Collingwood president, are said to be the most critical in recent memory. But the imminent US presidential election, the result of which we'll know, or like to think we'll know, in a fortnight, does seem unusually momentous. A fortnight ago, we heard from Michael Ondaatje about the Republican Party's fraught relations with black Americans, the subject of Michael's article in the October issue of ABR. Elsewhere in the current issue, Timothy Lynch reviews three new highly critical books about Donald Trump and his presidency. One written by a disaffected member of his family, the second by two veterans of the White House press room, and the third by a lifelong conservative and former member of Trump's cabinet. Timothy Lynch is an associate professor in American politics at the University of Melbourne. He has a new book out called In the Shadow of the Cold War, American Foreign Policy from George Bush Sr. to Donald Trump. It's great to have an opportunity to discuss this highly nuanced article on our podcast. Tim Lynch, welcome to the ABR podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Peter.
Tim, tell us about these three very different studies of Donald Trump.
Well, they're fascinating in their own way, but collectively represent something of a frontal assault on Trump. I think it's one that he has been and will be able to knock back, in part because I think they both confirm caricatures of the president without necessarily taking us any deeper into understanding who he is or indeed what he represents. So there is a kind of titillation and prurience which kept my interest and I think will keep the interest of others. But I left each of them unsatisfied by their explanations. In fact, they don't really deal in explanations. They're much more interested in dishing dirt on Trump, much of which I think we could probably imagine is the case without having to be told. So as chroniclers of with a certain insight and access, they're important accounts. But I don't think they take us any closer to understanding the Trump phenomenon. The Trump man, perhaps, but not the Trump phenomenon. And as a political scientist, that interests me more.
I flew through Mary Trump's book, and it's certainly titillating. Mary Trump is quite a wrathful niece, it must be said, bitter about the Trump family's treatment of her late father, Donald's elder brother, Fred Jr., and clearly resentful of her disinheritance. Mary Trump's a clinical psychologist, but despite this, you suggest that the psychological profiling in the book is humdrum. What brings Mary Trump's book undone to your mind and reduces it to a study in tedium, to borrow your phrase?
Yes, I think there's too much axe grinding. I mean, one would expect that, of course, in the work of an account of a disaffected niece who was gypped out of a significant inheritance, likely to be more than adequately compensated for by the sales of this book, rather ironically. But I don't want to claim that there's bad faith here, but I don't trust accounts of families by family members. Not if there is a certain animus, an animus that breathes through the book. I think a far more interesting account, had she chosen to take this approach, of course it's impossible because that's not who she is, would be a more politically neutral one. Almost from the outset, in the first few pages, her political allegiances are made clear. The problem with that is that becomes a lens through which we understand the familial exploration. So she feels Hillary Clinton was unjustly denied an office she'd spent a whole career pursuing by this malign uncle. Now, once that's established in the reader's mind, I become skeptical of any claim. So it's not that I don't believe the accounts of potato mash being put on young Donald's head to shut him up by Mary's father. I believe that. I'm just not sure that it takes us any further to an understanding of what Trump represents. Much of the accounts sort of dwell in just how iniquitous and malign and base and crude Trump is as a character. Okay, I get that, but there's a limit to how interesting we can find that profiling. What we need to do is as I explain in the review, without ever being satisfied with my own answer, is to try and explore why a man like that is so popular.
John Bolton isn't a man who could ever be accused of left-wing bias, as you note in the review. He's by far the most senior of these four authors. Bolton was Trump's longest-serving national security advisor. What do you make of his withering assessment of Trump's fitness to be president?
Well, because I do American foreign policy, I did find this book compelling from first to last, in part because methodologically it's quite different to the others, because it's based on first-hand experience. I mean, it plays on the notion of being in the room where it happened, taken from the Hamilton musical. So there is an immediacy and a judgmentalism which makes it absolutely compelling. I know some reviews have said it's just it's dull because it's so detailed. That's why I find it fascinating. I think Bolton is a fascinating character in and of himself. The first question I think one would have to ask is, why would a man so clearly at odds with his boss over the direction of American global power choose to be his chief foreign policy maker? And that puzzle is never quite resolved, beyond the rather obvious claim that you hear occasionally in the book, that he thinks he is deluded, as are many others, in thinking they can control Trump but by being close to him. So Bolton's frustration, I think, does highlight this basic feature of Trump's political and personal style, that everyone who comes into contact with him sees him as kind of childlike, a neophyte in the Washington game, and that with their expertise and tutelage, he will represent interests that they've always represented themselves. And Trump, to his credit, has never sold out to this kind of manipulation. You don't have to like him, I think, Peter, to recognize he has maintained a degree of authenticity which I think is unmatched in modern American political history, despite the efforts of all these insiders, Bolton particularly, par excellence, to try and manipulate him. He remains incapable of manipulation, subject to his own psychoses and pathologies. And that's I suppose, why Bolton's account becomes fascinating as well as frustrating on the behalf of the author. Because he's immune to change. There's no growth. It's been observed often by those who deign to psychoanalyze him, that what we're dealing with in the Trump in the 2010s and 2020s is the same Donald Trump that you can observe in the 1970s. A fairly crude, basic, but consistent worldview that he applies regardless of situation and circumstance.
In the review, you speak of a paradox that these three books can't resolve. Here I'm quoting you. Why is a man so chaotic, so reviled, so malignant, so transformational? I wonder if you can elaborate on that, and I realise that you've just touched on it.
Yes, I think the notion of transformation is often stated without being fully understood. I think as a general principle, we underestimate the capacity of the American system to transform itself. So America is, as an experiment in limited government, in the protection of individual rights, has known remarkable crisis and success, of course. Crisis being the Civil War, great success being the most powerful economic, military, cultural nation in the history of the world. So there's something about the character of US power, which can only be understood in terms of its transformational capacity, not only of itself, but of the rest of the world. I mean, a nation that was significantly racist through the 19th century and well into the 20th century also becomes the chief engine of anti-racism globally. Think of how LGBT rights were anathema 50 years ago in that country. And over that period, the great engine of their realization has been American civil discourse. So there is a capacity for transformation that we don't understand or don't understand well enough. Now, how does Trump fit into that? Well, I think Trump comes along and remarkably, he comes in after the apparently most transformational president in the history of the nation, Barack Obama. Of course, the great myth of Obama is that he was in any way transformational. He represents the high point of the American political establishment, a traditional, pragmatic, largely non-ideological in approach, risk-averse, and he is replaced by a man who promises to throw everything up in the air, to actually deal with some of the fundamental problems that afflict American culture and society, not least the turning around of the fortunes of middle America, of the deindustrialized American working class, blue-collar class. And no president, not in my lifetime, and I'm entering my sixth decade, no president has quite set out to do that, at least rhetorically. And largely, although inconsistently and imperfectly, has largely succeeded in making the cause of this forgotten middle central to American political discourse. That's why I think he's transformational. He has changed the dialogue and the discourse within each party. That might be another measure, Peter, I think, of his profound effect. He's made both wings of both parties reevaluate and recalibrate their message to groups of people they thought were on the way out and easy to ignore. And that transformational capacity, I think, will become more obvious and more remarked upon as we move into the post-Trump years. He's likely to undergo not a reevaluation of his character, but certainly of his impact, which I think will be profound.
And with that reevaluation in both parties, there's been a discernible drift leftward in the Democrats, and one that some people suggest that a Biden presidency would accelerate, really, in ways that probably would have been inconceivable when he was vice president to Obama and expected, I guess, to have a term after him. It's the Democratic Party now is looking pretty different from the Obama years.
Yes, there is something extraordinary that, given the hatred that Donald Trump engenders, that his opponents have never been able to come up with anybody half good to challenge him. He's been blessed by poor opponents. It's not an unusual, an uncommon trait. I think the same was said of Margaret Thatcher, the last leader that I can remember that engendered such animosity. But she was blessed by poor opposition. And I think the same applies to Trump. And of course, it's captured in the character, in the candidature of Joe Biden, who by any, I think, objective measure, clearly is a subpar candidate, given the sense of urgency that he's meant to represent. He's older than Trump, has no signal political achievement in his nearly 50 years of Washington insider service, and is really just a compromise candidate because the two wings within the Democratic Party couldn't forge a compromise except through this time-limited character, Joe Biden. So I mentioned in the piece that it's not impossible to imagine Trump might beat Biden. Increasingly, improbable. But Biden as the political manifestation of opposition to Trump, I think in some ways illustrates Donald Trump's success.
You suggest, if I'm reading you correctly, that there's a kind of collective failure going on here, a refusal or inability to even begin to explain why nearly 63 million Americans voted for the clown depicted so colourfully in these books. Has America ever been so riven, so polarised since the Civil War?
Well, I think clearly we're not in Civil War territory, but if your question is since the Civil War, yes, I think if one could look at the dislocations of the Great Depression, the political struggle over the New Deal, the civil rights movement of the 1960s, the changing in character of the Democratic Party itself from a racist, slave-owning party to one of that contends, purports to speak for black liberation. These all represent, I think, considerable conflicts within the American political establishment. Has Trump matched those? Well, I think to be consistent in terms of my claims of transformation, I would say that he hasn't caused, but he has represented a fundamental divergence in American politics, as we've seen played out since the early 1970s. And that, that somehow, by hook and by crook, successive American leaders have managed to duck and avoid, but which he has confronted frontally, often in quite crude terms. So the whole notion of identity politics, which was embedded in American political consciousness, if not in its academic discourse from the late 1970s, and certainly in this century, he's been prepared to deal in those, invoking all sorts of bad memories of a proclaimed, purported endemic racism endemic to the nation itself. Though I think it's wider than race. This division is wider than race. I don't think we're on the verge of a race war. I think we are on the verge of a full reckoning of and resolution to a culture war, which has been with us since the early 1970s. And in fact, I would date it to 1973 with Roe v. Wade. And neither side, though they've postured on being for and against this decision, neither side has actually joined in proper combat over it. They've sought outlets through the Supreme Court. Trump came along and said, no, we will resolve this culture war and the carnage that it's given the nation. So on that basis, I think he has stoked a conflict which has been there for at least the last 50 years and which most of his predecessors were prepared to duck and pretend could be gotten away from simply with better policy. So is it on the verge of a new civil war? No, I don't see what the fault lines are. Is it on the verge of renewed conflict and potentially of resolution because of Trump? Yes, I think I would maintain that argument.
As we all know, Bob Woodward has published another book about Donald Trump after copious interviews with the president. Gideon Haig has reviewed Rage for ABR. It's online now. Gideon, never one to mince his words, considers Trump a complete phony and monomaniac. Quote, the self-professed drainer of the swamp who has simply merged it with his own swamp of overt and covert self-dealing. Unquote. Yet Gideon notes that, and I'm quoting him again, every crisis, every bald-faced lie blows over or is dislodged by the next scandal du jour. Trump carries on as though nothing has changed, and the impression is he's indestructible, he's our guy, unquote. Isn't this very audacity in Trump, his brazenness, this sort of our guy-ness, if I can put it like that, often carried off with comic effect, that makes him so slippery and incomprehensible to his detractors?
Yes, I think there's a great truth in what Gideon writes there. I suppose my ultimate response would be, so what? We do understand that he has these character traits and psychoses and pathologies. What I require is why an unemployed auto worker from Scranton invests not just his and her vote in him, the faith in him, but invests a huge amount of their own self-identity and cultural connection in Donald Trump. And that I'm still not comfortable or satisfied with the answers that we've got to that question. He's slippery in lots of ways, not simply because of his own character, but also where he comes from. So most politicians like to run against other politicians with records of public service. It means that somewhere in their background, they owe someone something. I think Robert Caro is very good at dealing with this in his analysis of Robert Moses and also of LBJ. But in Trump's case, there is no political baggage. He's self-funded, self-made, seems to come from nowhere. There's no line of patronage that you can join or oppose, which makes him a very problematic political figure to counter, because he doesn't belong to anyone. He's not the product of any lineage, political, intellectual, or otherwise. He is a remarkable phenomenon that we struggle to explain, because he seems to come from nowhere.
None of these three books comes from the Academy. Do you think that your colleagues in the American universities are coming closer to explaining the phenomenon?
I think they're better than they were, though they couldn't be much worse. It's very hard to characterize without caricaturing what American academia is, because it's a hugely variable system. There's some of the best universities and some of the worst in the world. I think one of the problems, and I think I was victim to this 4 or 5 years ago, was this assumption that the way we understood the world was the right one, that it was essentially a struggle between the poor and oppressed and non-white peoples against the moneyed established elites, mostly white. And that led us to believe, it meant we forgot that group that Trump claims to represent, that forgotten, mostly white, though not exclusively, disaffected, alienated, culturally dispossessed, post-industrial demographic, that was not the concern of researchers and academics. When I go to the United States, I've tried to change this, but it's hard. I go to campuses. I visit think tanks. I spend my time in this swamp amongst the intellectual elite. I wasn't mixing with unemployed miners in Appalachia. I wasn't gauging the anger of those grandparents who had seen their grandchildren die of opioid overdose. These groups that Trump spoke to were almost entirely off the agenda of academics and intellectuals. And Trump has put them back there. He's made us think that identity politics is not simply about anti-racism or correcting the iniquities of white supremacy. It applies to white people too. And white people, dispossessed, poor, downtrodden white people, can have a very profound sense of ethnic identity in a way I think we've been uncomfortable accepting.
Tim Lynch, there must be a great book to be written about Donald Trump. Perhaps it won't be written until long after his death, when the dust has settled. It occurs to me that he may even need a great novelist to do him justice. I think a Philip Roth or Norman Mailer might have had fun with Donald Trump in 2020. But do you think he'll ever attract a Robert Caro? Not that Robert Caro's grow on trees.
Yes, it's a fascinating speculation, Peter. I think my concern is if the focus is Trump the man, in a way that Caro's approach to Robert Moses and LBJ was at that, it was those individuals as political characters. If that's the approach, you'll run out of information or run out of fascination pretty quickly. I think you can come to terms with what Trump is at a personal level really pretty quickly. I mean, he has this desire. I mean, it's hard to capture it, of course, in a statement, but I've heard it said that the difference between Trump and pretty much any other man that's held that office is that most of the other men have sought notoriety to achieve political power, whereas Donald Trump has sought political power to achieve and maintain his notoriety. Now, if the only thing that drives him is this kind of desire for fame and some of its trappings, how interesting is that ultimately? Whereas an LBJ and a Moses and a Reagan and a Clinton, and you name any of them, those who have been subject to very great biographies, there's something about their pursuit of political power which is absolutely fascinating and central to their political identity, which I just don't think Trump has. I go back to my initial concerns about all these three books that I reviewed, is that it's the phenomenon, it's the appeal that is important, not its source, not Donald Trump himself. So I'd be skeptical that there's a Caro treatment of Trump out there, because I think you could read any chapter of the books that I've reviewed here and come up with a pretty good working definition of who Trump is. What is missing, without laboring the point, is an explanation of why that kind of empty character, that vacuity in his soul, should be so appealing to so many people.
One final question, Tim. At the end of your article, you marvel that Donald Trump's myriad disasters in the handling of COVID-19 haven't signed his political death warrant. At the time, you rated his re-election as a distinct possibility, as did Gideon Haig, writing a little later than you. In the past fortnight, we've been treated to Trump's boorish behaviour at the debate and his preposterous boasts about surviving COVID-19, despite the death of more than 210,000 of his compatriots. Recent national polls give Joe Biden a commanding lead. Do you still consider Trump a viable candidate?
Well, I think the ground has moved some over the last 3 or 4 months, and certainly since the drama and the histrionics of Trump's contraction of the disease. I suppose I'd stick to my claim that a Trump second victory is possible, though I'd add it looks increasingly improbable. I don't think that COVID has been necessarily handled especially badly by him. Not, I mean, handled badly, but compared to what? Compared to Boris Johnson, compared to the French, the Italians? I mean, the death rates are not dissimilar. I mean, this is a silly league table, of course, to try and construct. But it's not clear to me that his ineptitude was any greater than any other apparently competent leader or administration. What I think people are asking themselves in the US is one or both of these questions. How do I feel normal again after a year of remarkable dislocations caused by the virus? And the second one is, who is best able to lead us into the economic uplands to recover from the disasters, the economic disasters of COVID? And I think the former question is being asked to the favor of Joe Biden. That Joe Biden, though he's enervating and old and a reminder of an apparently displaced order, also represents normalcy, that peculiar word that Americans use, a return to normality. And I think that's going to get preference over the chutzpah of Donald Trump claiming there's going to be a V-shaped recovery. So I think a basic sense of resignation, of please, can we get beyond this, is probably not going to work in Trump's favor this time. So that would be my prediction, which is, I would warn you, I'm not a betting man. My predictions are often wrong, but I do trust Peter this time more to the polling, which has remained robustly in Biden's favor over several months, whereas we know 4 years ago there were moments when Trump overtook Hillary Clinton. I think this year, unless something remarkable happens between now and polling day, I think it's Biden's to lose.
Indeed. We'll see. Thanks so much for reviewing these three books, this collective frontal assault on Trump, as you described it. I hope you will come back on the ABR podcast after the election. Timothy Lynch, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure, Peter, and I look forward to doing this again. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Australian Book Review podcast. We're most grateful to Clancy Balin, who edits our podcast. If you liked this episode, consider subscribing to ABR. Subscriptions start from just $10 per month for digital. Subscribers have access to new issues and also our vast digital archive going back to 1978, a unique critical resource. Subscribers can enter our three lucrative prizes at a discounted rate. You can also follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Visit our website for more information, australianbookreview.com.au. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving a review on iTunes.